Why do I conduct my show on this matter, Mundo?
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mundo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bowtie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mundo!
All six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mundo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mundo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spell that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
And welcome once again to yet another episode of the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration. Once again, let me remind you, the blog is cupofjoe.blogspot.com. That's cupofjoe.blogspot.com. And you can email me at joevec@bellsouth.net. This is show number 26, and right now it is Wednesday, about quarter after 1, April 21st, 2004. Before I do anything, I want to talk a little bit about the music that I play on the show. And today we're going to do nothing but TV themes, just for this show. And I've done this from time to time. I like TV themes, and I like movie themes. And, you know, I really don't have a lot of time to pick the music that I do. I usually do it during the show, and that sometimes takes me more time than actually recording the show, because I try to figure out what. And there are some people who are sending me stuff, Rick Hill, who emails me, and he sent me to a place that had a whole bunch of protest songs. And while I appreciate, you know, people sending me stuff, and I certainly want people to send me stuff, you know, I'm not into the protest stuff. I mean, to me, that's just kind of 60s. And that's just the way I see it. It's like, I realize some of the TV themes are old, but, you know, that's not the same thing. I asked for something new, and Billy Shears kind of chided me, saying, I sent you something new and you didn't play it. And I said, I still kind of have to like it. Billy Shears is from the White Rose Society website. By the way, my archives are available on thewhiterosesociety.org, just as it's spelled like a sound, www.whiterosesociety.org. You can listen to all of my shows. All 26 episodes you can listen to. I only keep the one show on my server to save on bandwidth space and on storage space, because I only have so much room. And I actually keep some very high-quality copies of the show for myself. I do that intentionally. And also going to be available, I hope, soon on powerradio.org, or is it powerradio.com? One of those two. And they're going to be putting my show on their regular schedule. At least I hope so. The guy's been talking to me, but I have yet to see them on there. So if you're listening, hey, get on the ball. Get the damn show up there. Why should I? I shouldn't be so mean to people. But anyway, I just wanted to thank Rick. And, you know, and really, and I apologize in advance if I don't use the music, but I still have to like it. And there's no, in my case, there's no accounting for taste. I mean, I like what I like. And that's just basically it. And I really don't have any other answer to that. It's just that I like what I like, and that's just the way I am. It was an interesting day at work yesterday. I got to talk about this before I talk about this Walmart thing. It happened at now again, for those of you who don't know, that I work on a paint line, basically, where we have an overhead conveyor belt where the steel parts that are made get hung on the line. There are little hooks, and it's like a moving conveyor belt that goes all around, and it goes into the paint thing. Then the steel is put on the hooks, and it goes around, and basically my job is to pull it off the line and sack it neatly, whether it be boxes or what we call trim, which is the smaller items that you screw inside the boxes. We make circuit boxes, basically, for electrical outlets, stuff that they use mostly in construction stuff. And you can actually, if you go to Home Depot, you can find them there. Siemens, S-I-E-M-E-N-S, one of the biggest companies in the world, they kind of produce it. At any rate, now, you know, we have, once it finishes where we do it, when we stack it, the guy with a forklift comes and pulls out. And we had an accident yesterday. It could have been a lot more serious than it was. And what happened was that the forklift driver was moving the forklift up a little bit to get a box that was, like, behind the line. And I guess he was in a hurry or he just wasn't paying attention, but he moved it too far up. And one of the hooks from the conveyor belt caught in the top of the forklift and almost tipped it over. These forklifts weigh about 2 tons, okay? They're very heavy. They have to be because they lift very heavy stuff. Because they lift stuff that's sometimes, you know, a ton, almost 2 tons itself. So they have to be very heavy so they can lift stuff. And that's how much torque it is on this conveyor belt. It almost tipped this thing over. And it would have if he hadn't backed out quickly. Before it got too entangled in there, then he might have actually dragged that forklift halfway down the line. And that would have been a scary sight. That was just one of a couple of things that happened. We had a problem with the paint. Sometimes the paint doesn't go on properly. I was getting some boxes down, and I said, this doesn't look right. And I called one of the other forklift drivers. The guy's been here for a long time. And he took a look at the box and said, holy crap, holy shit. And he just turned the line right off, which nobody likes to do. But in this case, we didn't have any choice because the paint was coming. And basically, we had to let the stuff go back around the line. And we actually wound up throwing away a lot of stuff, which is a damn shame. You hate to see that kind of waste. And according to my coworker Dave, this stuff happens a lot more often because they're using a different type of paint now than they used to about 2 or 3 years ago that they never had any problem with. But the company decided to save a few bucks and use this cheaper kind of paint, and this, of course, is the result. It happens every now and then. This is as bad as I have ever seen it, but every now and then we get some really spotty paint jobs. So, anyway, I was led to... this particular, now, you know, my least favorite store in the country is Walmart. And there was an article about it in the New York Times, basically talking about how it's called Walmart, a Nation Unto Itself. You won't be able to find it in the archives. You'd have to go directly to the link. But it's in the New York Times. It was on April 17th, which was 4 days ago. It's by Stephen Greenhouse. And as you know, Walmart recently tried in Inglewood, California, to bypass the normal way of doing business with the government, so to speak, and put a voter initiative on the California ballot for Inglewood to try to get one of their stores built and bypass environmental regulations and labor regulations and districting regulations and all that stuff. And the voters, God bless them, turned them down. There was a big number, too, like 2-1. And It was real good that they did that, and I was very happy for that. But Walmart is a massive, massive organization. And what basically happened was some sociologists were taking a look at Walmart as it applies. Okay, there were people from the University of California. It was a conference. 250 sociologists, anthropologists, historians, and other scholars gathered at the University of California on Monday, which I suppose is last Monday, for a conference on Walmart, and they came looking for more than just the company's vital statistics. That's a good word. Statistics, ladies and gentlemen. Like archaeologists who pick over artifacts to understand an ancient society, the scholars were examining Walmart for insights into the very nature of American capitalist culture. As Susan Strasser, a history professor at the University of Delaware, said, Walmart has come to represent something that's even bigger than it is. And when you consider that Walmart makes $256 billion a year and has 20 million shoppers a day in total in all of its stores, that's a rather remarkable thing. 20 million shoppers a day. Think of this, 300 million people in this country. So that's a pretty big percentage. And they talk about how in the 19th century, the standard-setting company was Pennsylvania Railroad. In the mid-20th century, it was General Motors. And in the late 20th century, Microsoft. And today, it's Walmart, which rezones American cities, sets wage standards, and even conducts diplomacy with other countries. In fact, by itself, Walmart is China's eighth largest trading partner. That's remarkable. That's just remarkable. But unlike General Motors, which is the last really, really big, I mean, Microsoft was kind of there, but they didn't employ the huge amount of numbers that General Motors did. GM helped build the world's most affluent middle class by paying wages far above the average and by providing generous health and pension plans. GM's wage pattern spurred other companies to raise compensation levels. Now, Walmart does just the opposite. They have low wages and benefits, and in fact, the workers at Walmart average less than $18,000 a year. The company's pay scale and hard-nosed labor practices, according to Simon Head, who is a fellow at the Century Foundation and author of The New Ruthless Economy, Work and Power in the Digital Age, mean that Walmart is certainly a template of 21st century capitalism, but a capitalism that increasingly resembles a capitalism of 100 years ago. He said it combines the extremely dynamic use of technology with a very authoritarian and ruthless managerial culture. As reported on this program a little while ago, from other news sources, of course, because I can't do any reporting. I do everything by myself. Walmart was one of the companies that was basically the managers were going in there and deleting hours from employees so that they can lower their payroll. Just not paying them for hours they worked. And that is the most sickening, disgusting thing. Walmart representatives refused to attend because they said the agenda looked pretty biased against Walmart. Well, duh. Now, if Walmart is helping to revolutionize labor relations, and I dispute that term, this is not revolutionizing it. This is downgrading it. This is destroying it. It's not revolutionizing it. What's new, what's being done is hardly revolutionary. Hardly revolutionary. It's just the same old stuff repackaged. But it is changing consumer patterns. It is the leading, according to some of the people there, it is the leading example of a shift towards mass merchandising, which has transformed customers into consumers. Many Americans no longer deal daily with craftsmen and neighborhood shopkeepers who give them advice on goods. Advertising is the source of shoppers' information. Walmart has made a traditional sales force obsolete for another reason. When retailing began centuries ago, salesmen were needed to explain goods to the customers. But Walmart follows a different model. Using technology, the company collects detailed information on the billions of purchases its customers make each year. Based on that information, it orders products at low prices, confident that customers will like the merchandise and the prices, thus eliminating some of the need for an informed sales force. You know, some of this stuff I do not have a problem with. I mean, obviously it makes good sense for a company to keep good records of what its customers are buying and be efficient enough to know what's going to be coming up in a year so that they know what to order. And again, I don't have a problem with that. To me, that's good business practice. What's bad business practice is paying your workers like crap. And not paying them benefits or not helping them get benefits and basically just being very anti-worker. To me, that's the bottom line with Walmart. If they were to follow the GM business model and give better, and really help people and pay people enough. I mean, even Henry Ford, who ran the Ford Motor Company, understood that it doesn't do any good if people can't afford to buy your products. So, Ford and GM, what they did was they paid people enough so that they could afford to buy the stuff that they were making, thus keeping them in business. In Walmart, what they do is they buy everything so cheaply, and they keep their labor costs low, and it's a bad cycle. It's a deflationary cycle. It's in reverse from what it should be, where you pay people more so they buy more. Here they're paying people less, so they're only capable of spending less. And therefore, they go to Walmart because of cheaper prices. I know people at work who praise Walmart left and right, and I keep telling them, do not shop there. I do not shop there. I will not set foot in another Walmart until or if they ever change their labor practices, which I doubt that they will. But don't go there. Force them to do the right thing by their workers and the right thing by their customers and the right thing by the neighborhoods that they live in. And special after special talks about how one of these big rectangular stores come in and basically destroy all the local businesses. And in some cases, once there's no more money to be had out of a town, they basically pack up and leave a desert behind them. I don't go that far, but, you know, they basically just wreck everything. And these are not good, solid, traditional business practices. These are really nasty, ruthless people. And the only people who could stop them are the federal government. And, of course, the federal government is certainly all for this because it's being run by a bunch of people who have never really had to work Walmart kinds of jobs. And even if they do, they only work them temporarily knowing that they've got something else because of family connections or because of wealth. But in a lot of situations, they just simply, you know, they're never going to be in a position that working people like you and I are in. Yeah. We don't want to make millions of dollars. We just want to support our families and make a better life for ourselves. And Walmart is a detriment to that. By shopping there, you are lowering your expectations and lowering the benefits that you're going to wind up getting in the long run. Maybe in the short term you save a couple of dollars on an item because a lot of the stuff is produced in China and Vietnam and other places where they pay much, much lower wages. But basically, they're taking advantage of the fact that there's no global labor laws so that they can have higher cheap labor and keep their prices low and not pay as much. And basically, American workers like American unions are having more and more of a problem maintaining any kind of power because they don't have a bargaining chip when it comes to the company saying, well, we're just going to move to China. And even though in the long run, I think companies are going to find out that this outsourcing, which is now the new code word for whatever, just the latest catchphrase, that's not going to be profitable for them in the long run. We need a global labor market. This is why I talk about, when I talked about Pax Liberalis, the free peace, about how we needed a unified global government because we need to have these kind of global standards for wages and for working conditions and stuff like that. It's not going to be easy, and it's going to take a long time, but I think it's necessary to prevent this sort of thing. And the more you get big, big companies like Walmart, and especially the more that they control the government, then the more danger there's going to be. And you know, it's more than just Republicans versus Democrats. I've said this before. The Democrats can be just as bad about this because they want to protect their interests too. But if you change the campaign finance system and make it less meaningful for these big companies as far as, you know, plowing money into the system, if you take that away, then we'll have a more equitable thing. Because then the congressman or somebody might actually look at what's better for their constituents rather than looking out for the interests of somebody who's just paying a lot of money for their campaign chests. Anyway, let's have some music, and we're going to come back with a special guest, my friend Dave Merrill, and he's going to talk about his job, and we're going to talk about the business of running an anime convention, a Japanese animation convention. Don't go away. We'll be right back on the Cup of Joe radio show.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 for me. Survival.
Dream. a diver, was a freedom rider. She didn't care if the whole world would. Joan of Arc with the Lord to guide her. She was a sister who really could. Isadora was the first bra burner. Ain't you glad she showed up? The country was falling apart. Betsy Ross got it all sewed up.
And then there's Maud.
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 And then there's
Maud. That uncompromising, enterprising, anything but tranquilizing. Right on, Maud.
Curtis, theme from Mary Tyler Moore Show. That is actually from the first season of Mary Tyler Moore, and that's called Love Is All Around. And then when, you know, she throws her hat in the air, you know, we ruined that song for my niece, Kathy, not my wife, Kathy, because there's this old, if you look at the opening credits, when she throws her hat in, there's this old blue-haired woman with glasses and the scarf and everything, just this crabby-looking old woman just looking at us like, what are you doing? And every time you throw her hat, you look at that woman, you say, who was she? And my niece says, how can you, you know, you told me about that. I can't watch that thing anymore without seeing that old woman and wondering who the hell she is. Now, before that, we had Donny Hathaway with And Then There's Maud. And we began the whole segment with Cindy Greco with the Laverne and Shirley theme, Making Our Dreams Come True. And that is, we're doing television themes here on the show. And that is my salute to the women of television.
Welcome back to the Cup of Joe Radio Show. I'm your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration. If my voice sounds funny, it's because, once more, I'm doing a phone interview, and on the phone I have actually an old friend of mine who I've worked with in the past. His name is Dave Merrill, and he's been on the show before. Welcome back, Dave.
Hello, Joe.
And
what do you know?
You don't have time for that, man. You just don't have time for that.
That's a vaudeville routine. Hello, Joe. What do you know? I just
got back from the vaudeville
show.
At least you didn't ask me where I was going with that gun in my hand. I get that a lot.
I'm going to shoot my old lady.
Yeah.
Caught her messing around.
With another man. That's right. Now, Dave was on. We were just doing a show about anime and anime songs, but we're going to talk to Dave about something a little bit different. Now, Dave and I have worked together in the past. And Dave works, where do you work, Dave? Not the specific company, but in what field do you work?
I work for a wholesale printing company.
Printing company. What exactly do you do for a wholesale printing company?
Right now I am a second shift bindery supervisor.
Okay, so you don't run the Docutech machine?
Oh, I do a little bit of everything.
Okay.
Well, I'm the guy after everyone else goes home, I'm the guy that has to make sure that things get done.
Is this your first supervisory position?
I believe it is.
Wow. Is it a different feeling for you being a supervisor as opposed to just being an hourly worker? Because, you know, you've got a reputation for being a slacker. No offense, but you're like this new age, you know, this new,
I wish.
You know. But I know you're a hard worker, but, you know, it's like, you know, the teen thing. You know what I mean? I mean, you know, you're older than that, but you were part of that whole 90s.
I was part of that grunge generation.
Yeah,
I saw Nirvana before they hit it big.
Oh, wow.
So. That was the loudest band I'd ever heard in my life.
So now you're a supervisor, and how does it, you know, maybe I should ask you, like with Lando Calrissian, how does it feel to be a responsible person?
Well, the crazy part about it is, you know, when I was running Docutex on second shift, they give you a big list of jobs you have to do, and you make sure all those jobs get done. And now they give me a big list of jobs that me and the other people have to do. and I have to make sure those jobs get done. So, there's really actually not that much difference.
Now, let's before I get into my next series of questions, which is going to be about your management attitude, let's talk a little bit about the DocuTech itself. That's a fairly complicated piece of equipment. Explain what the DocuTech is.
DocuTech is Xerox's proprietary sort of digital copier printer. It's a big old thing. It does 135 copies a minute. It's got a scanner on it. You can scan documents in. It was pretty much developed. It's like late 70s, early 80s technology. So if you can think of something that's got sort of a Stone Age version of, it's like the Flintstones version of Photoshop mixed with a laser printer and a scanner. So you can do cutting and pasting and cropping and a little bit of editing of images. And, you can scan large documents in and you can print them out and they staple. It's a great machine. I really do enjoy the Xerox DocuTech.
And it was one of the first machines, if I'm not mistaken, that can take like an image file or like a PDF file and print it directly from the file.
Well, I wish. You have to import the PDF into... Xerox has a proprietary file system. They call it DocuGlob file, which... I'm serious, that's what they call it, DocuGlob.
Okay.
So you have to, and we've got various software that does it, and there are a whole bunch of people that make different packages. And you can take an image file and convert it, you can print it out, turn it into a PRM file, and then send it over to your DocuTech. So yeah, you can do that.
It was a lengthy process, but it was...
It's a little more complicated. Xerox has some new software that's a lot easier to use, and we don't have that software where I work.
And there were also several different attachments. I remember we were doing booklets that you could just, it would send the paper right out the end of it and it would get folded and stapled.
It's a great machine. It's the cornerstone of the desktop. I don't want to say desktop. It's the print-on-demand revolution, really, for printing. Is that in the old days, you wanted to print a book, you had to take your artwork, your pages, you had to shoot negatives of them, you had to burn plates off those negatives. You had to put those plates on the press and then run it, and that was it. Once you burned that plate, it was etched in the metal. You couldn't change it.
And even with the new technology, with the web and the Internet and people just transferring files back and forth, there's still a huge demand for print, isn't there?
Oh, there's more print than ever before.
It's remarkable. You would think that as we get more into the electronic age, that sort of thing would disappear, kind of like the horse and buggy disappearing.
What's happening is that the digital revolution is making it easier to print things on paper.
Just like it's making it easier for schmucks like me to do a little radio show. And
well,
send
exactly.
It out to everybody.
They're talking about the death of radio and stuff, and what computers are doing and making it easier for people to present entertainment in an audio format.
And now we have, with computers creating PDF files and other form of files, people can just go on and create something. And in fact, they don't even have to leave their house. They can send it to a shop like yours through email.
Certainly.
And then you can print it up and even deliver it.
Certainly.
And the guy never even had to show it. And you could probably, I assume you have a way of paying online or...
you give them their credit card number.
Okay, see? And that still works out. So you can do something without ever leaving your house. And in fact, if you were putting together some sort of event and you wanted to have flyers sent to that place, you can do the whole thing from your computer in a couple hours, get the whole transaction done, and, however long it takes you guys to print it out.
Oh, sure, sure.
And then
sure.
It gets done. So
I like to leave my house.
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is, it's just neat that that can be done. Obviously, if you're getting an order, you want to take a look at it before it goes out the door.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah. Oh, I think both of us can tell some stories about that, about some jobs that have come out and say, no.
I didn't want it to be like that.
What was it that old? It was like a Charlie Brown thing, and Charlie Brown was...
Yeah, it was office art. It's they take cartoon characters and redraw them and add new dialogue and... It was Charlie Brown was at the door like he was going to... It was actually from a strip where he's shoveling walks, and this little girl is giving him sarcastic answers, and the little girl is now saying, yeah, well, if we do business with you, you have to sign this contract saying that you'll only do business with us forever, and that we can lower the prices whenever we want, and you will deliver all orders on, at such and such a time on this exact date, and this is subject to change on our end without notice, and... You agree to, all these stupid restrictions. The last panel, Charlie Brown's going, fuck you.
it almost works that way in the print industry. It's not a high, even with all the volume, it's not really a high profit industry necessarily. You really have to work to make a profit on that.
I'll tell you right now, business is slow. And this is why I was kind of whacked out when you wanted me to talk about management. Because the owners of my business, they haven't taken a paycheck in months and months.
Well, I'm sure obviously they're living off of something.
Well, they're living off of something. I mean, their wives work and everything.
Right.
But they have sunk so much money into this business that they cannot afford to take a paycheck from it. And right. I really respect that.
Well, that's good, you know, because we work for some people who just love to stiff their employees so that they can get, you know, a BMW or something like that. And I think
one thing I learned in the printing industry, you know, you go into it and you're thinking, well, hey, you print something, you sell it, everybody's happy.
Right.
And it's nowhere near that simple.
Well, you are what they call middle management. If you were in the military, you'd be a staff sergeant, basically.
That's the rank I had when I was in ROTC in high school.
Oh, cool. And what kind of management philosophy did you take with you now that you're someone who's actually responsible for people other than himself? What type of attitude do you take towards the people who are underneath you in that sense?
No, we just have to get the job done. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I've always been, my opinion is, I don't care how you do it. And happily, I'm at a company that shares that opinion. Is we don't care pretty much how you do it as long as it gets done and it looks good.
Now, let's say for the sake of argument that I am the owner of the shop and I like things done a certain way and I really like to micromanage. How would you react to me saying no? Even though the product was getting done,
well,
you know, in an efficient manner.
You know,
I just say no. It's got to be done this way. How would you react to something like that?
Well, you know, as long as my paycheck clears, I'm going to do it the way they say.
Mm-hmm. And what if he was like pressuring you to put pressure on the people underneath you? I mean, that can be a difficult decision
for
a manager.
Very difficult, yeah.
Because you know, I was fortunate when I ran the 1 hour lab that I really did not have a district manager or anybody on my back, and you're very fortunate in that. You know, being a middle manager is a really difficult position, don't you think? Because you're kind of supposed to be responsible, but you're still not really an ownership or, you know, a shareholder or anything like that.
Well, I think the situation we have, it's very clear to all the employees that when we do good work, we get more business and we get more work and we get more money. And when we do bad work, people leave. The print industry customers are fickle. They will leave you in a second if they can get a better price.
Right.
Down the road.
Well, I'm glad you're are you happy with being in management and doing what you're doing now?
I think it's a challenge, you know. It's if you do the same thing all the time, you get really bored. I get terribly bored when I'm not challenged at work. I've lost jobs because I quit being challenged and I started goofing off.
Yeah, I've had jobs like that too. Certainly, and at some places that we have worked at together too. Now, It's interesting that you're in the printing industry because it kind of ties in with your main hobby, which is something that you want to be a professional at, which is being an artist.
Oh yeah.
And how many little different stories and projects have you done over the course of your career as a cartoonist? And obviously, it has not been a tremendously profitable thing. Otherwise, you still wouldn't be working in the printing industry.
There is no money in comic books, you know, right now, except for like 5% of the people working in the industry.
Well, you just went to a comic book show over the weekend, Atlanta Comic Con, and you were telling me that it was practically, well, I wouldn't say empty.
It wasn't empty, but there were people there, and there were a lot of people, you know, hanging out and talking, but there wasn't a whole, like, usually these shows, you see a lot of people walking around with gigantic stacks of comics they bought. You know, I bought all these comics, and I did not see anybody walking around with lots and lots of comics at the show. It looked like people were, they're shopping, but they're not buying, you know?
Right.
If that makes any sense.
No, I understand. People are looking around. Do you think because, you know, for Atlanta, we have one really, really, really big convention, and that's Dragon Con.
Yeah.
Do you think people go to these shows like that, and they look, and they just see if they can find something that they can't normally find at Dragon Con, which is rare enough?
Well, Dragon Con actually is really terrible comics. They had almost no comic book dealers. And when I go to a show like that, I'm looking for cheesy, well, I don't want to say cheesy, but I'm looking for children's comics from the 50s and 60s and 70s. I'm not looking for anything expensive or particularly hard to find.
Well, you're a big fan of those, like, Lois Lane, Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah, Shane's got a whole bunch of great, great Lois Lanes.
Now,
there's a terrific one where Superman and Batman team up to play a trick on Lois Lane. It is the cruelest story you'll ever read.
Oh, my God. What do they do to her?
Well, so for some crazy reason, Superman's out of town, and he gives Batman an anti-gravity belt and a Superman mask and has Batman cover for him.
Okay.
So Lois Lane happens to see, like watching Superman land, and he takes off his Superman mask, and it's Bruce Wayne. And Lois Lane's like, holy shit, it's Bruce Wayne. He's Superman. Oh, man, I'm going to marry his ass. So she starts chasing after Bruce Wayne. And Bruce is like, what the hell am I going to do? So Superman comes back into town, and Bruce Wayne tells him about it. And they're like, well, damn. So they lead her on all the way to the fucking altar. And they are having the marriage ceremony.
Oh, my God.
And then Superman shows up. He just lands and says, hey, Lois, heard you're getting married. And Lois is like, oh, my God. And she goes to Bruce and says, well, if you're not Superman, I can't marry you.
Oh, man. Who dreams up that?
I know. Well, Mort Weisinger. And, I mean, that's the thing, though, is that you have these characters, and obviously, I mean, I don't think it's a story motivated by hatred of women. It's just a logical extension, you know. She's always trying to marry Superman, and, well, what if, you know, it just goes on from there. And then, you know, you're trapped. You have to go all that way.
Now, your other hobby, apart from being a cartoonist, well, I hesitate to call it a hobby because it does take up a lot of your time. And it's something you've been doing while going, this will be year 11, won't it?
I found the list of all the comics I've done, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Cool.
And Ozone Commando's early pages, Ozone Commando's movie special, Ozone Commando's Dojinshi, Desperados, Robot X, Hazard Von Braun, Astronaut, Detective, Super Mechanical Fighting Team, Jesus.
Yeah, that's the one with the giant robot,
which
Jesus.
Which is available in the latest manga comic volume, Drunk Tank.
Now, is that, yeah, that's the one that your latest is
yeah.
for sale. You have a website that you're selling that on?
Not yet.
Okay. Well, you do have a live journal, though.
Yeah, you can email me at davidrmerrill@yahoo.com.
Okay. Let's
see. Space Worms, Cataclysm, and Astro Nebula, M17, Night of the Living Trek. Those last two were with Ed Hill. Fearless Vampire Hecklers, Off-Screen Action Comics, Elvis at Home, Pettings, and I Hate Art.
The one with the super mechanical Jesus, is that the same giant robot Jesus that's in Ozone Commandos?
Well, it's very similar, but in the Ozone Commandos context, it's CB that sort of turns into Jesus, kind of like Ultraman.
Okay, see?
Whereas the comic book Super Mechanical Fighting Team Jesus, it's five kids who get into vehicles which turn into the robot.
Okay, I should mention to our audience that CB is our friend CB Smith. If that's who you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
CB? Yeah. And he's part of Corn Pone Flicks, and actually I hope to get he and Matt Murray on the show one day, too, just to talk about stuff.
Actually,
like
I actually got to see Matt.
Oh, really?
Last week.
Wow. Again, he used to work with you at the same place.
Yes, he did, indeed. The same place, the name of which I'm not going to mention. They've gone through bankruptcy twice now.
Oh, God.
By the way. Speaking of crazy bosses.
Well, let me talk to you about your other hobby, apart from being a... Well, again, I hesitate to call it a hobby, and I don't like to call being a cartoonist a hobby because you do want to make it your profession, and it's certainly an honorable one. But something you've been doing now for going on 11 years,
mm-hmm.
and that's Anime Week in Atlanta. Now, let's mm-hmm. talk a little bit about... Now, you know, you're a middle manager now officially in the workforce, but as an Anime Week in Atlanta, you're acting as essentially a CEO.
I have to be the figurehead.
The figurehead. Well,
the
you are
spiritual leader.
But you are more of than you're more than like George W. Bush is like, you know, a puppet president. You're not a puppet president. You are really the spirit behind.
Yeah. Well, the only thing I admire about Ronald Reagan's presidency is it becomes easier to explain the sort of I don't want to say it's a hands-off management technique. But you pick good people to do the jobs, and then you back them up.
Right.
And then you can say, well, I'm letting blank handle this. I am not going to stand over shoulder and nitpick him to death. I'm going to let him do his job. I don't care how he does it.
That's a good management principle, so long as you actually have decent, solid people.
Well, that's the trick. And you have, when you find bad people, you got to get rid of them.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they tend to be a little too loyal to their dead people, like we just found out with Mr. Negroponte going to IAC, and I was like, what is the deal with that? So,
well, I don't know what's good. You see that thing where, Hagel's calling for a draft now?
Yep.
What the hell?
Well, you know, I kept telling people it's going to come. I said that they weren't going to be able to subdue Iraq.
Dude,
he is going to be
selling ice cream come next year.
God.
Nobody, it's like, dude, no one's going to vote for a draft in this country.
Oh, well, you know, if
the Russians bomb Pearl Harbor, sure. Until then, forget it.
But I saw a poll in the USA Today that said support is growing. It didn't say anything about what the poll is. It said support is growing for more troops. And it's like,
well,
that's a really misleading thing. First of all, you know, if it went up from like 4% to 6% to say that we should, that the poll is growing. But it's still a pretty insignificant number.
We're eating more beets.
We're eating more beets. No, let's get back on the subject of the convention, because we could talk about the politics stuff all night. And I know you discuss that in your live journal, and I get into it sometimes in my blog, but not as much as others do. Let's talk a little bit about the business of running a convention, about financing it. Now, when the whole thing first started, let's go over the story. Now, I was there with you, even though I was technically one of the big three. I really wasn't one of the guys who was as active getting the hotel and doing all that stuff. So let's talk about the business of getting one started and what you have to do. And now this is a convention for Japanese cartoons, so it's not like you're doing a business convention. It's not the same type of deal. Although you have a lot of very similar things. You have seminars, you know, little panels where people talk about stuff.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
So talk about the process of how you got started with the idea of doing the convention to begin with, and you know, how you went about doing it.
Well, we had a Japanese cartoon club in Atlanta for years and years. I helped start one here in 1985.
And that was Anime X, is correct?
Actually, it was the CFO Atlanta.
CFO Atlanta. The CFO, for those of you who don't know, is the old Cartoon Fantasy Organization, which was a national fandom organization.
Still exists.
It still exists, but it's pretty much all in California now, isn't it? Just the one or two chapters.
They don't allow any talking during their meetings.
Oh, really?
I saw one of their newsletters.
Oh, that's horrible.
Well, they're very, they got their rules. So anyway, we had a club, and we had a lot of people who liked Japanese cartoons. And in 1990, the first national anime convention started in Dallas. Actually, I want to say national. The first anime only. The first convention devoted to fans of Japanese cartoons. That started in Dallas in 1990, and I was there 1990. And, you know, it's like 1992, 1993, 1994, and more these conventions start coming up. And around 1994, we're kind of like, well, you know, if we don't do it, and we meaning... you know, you and me, Lloyd Carter and Stan Dahlin, Gordon Waters and Patrick McCullough.
Matt Buffington. Don't
Matt
forget Matt.
Buffington.
Matt was a huge
help
for that.
He was vital.
Yeah.
And we said, if we don't do it, somebody else is going to do it, and we won't like it if they do it. So we'd better do it.
Well, I think for Anime Weekend, it was a case of a lot of different pieces coming, falling into place in the same time.
Because Derek Jackson... had a lot of friends. He moved here from Orlando, and he had a lot of friends around the country. He had the computer skills that, you know, and people were using email, and people were, you know, little networks back and forth, but the Internet really hadn't taken off as, you know, a real communication tool then.
Right. There were websites out there, but it really hadn't...
Primitive.
Yeah.
But he was the guy. He knew a lot of people. He had a party here and invited a lot of out-of-town people. And I had a party and invited a lot of out-of-town people. That's 94. And we're like, well, damn, you know, we could just have a party and call it a convention. You know, and our first year was at a terrible rundown hotel called the Castlegate, which has been demolished.
Yeah, well, it took them a while. They found how many dead bodies in there?
I don't know. I know one officially that I know of, officially. But it took a very long time for them to demolish it.
Well, we could spend days just talking with stories about the Castlegate, which was a classic hotel.
Castlegate was the I don't want to say, it was pretty much the epicenter for the fan community in Atlanta, because every convention held at least one at the Castlegate,
mm-hmm.
because it had a lot of space and it was very cheap, and they didn't care what you did.
Did Dragon ever hold one year at the Castlegate?
I believe the first Dragon Con was at the Castlegate.
Okay, I'm not sure about that. We'll have to check. And Dragon Con is now like the freaking 800-pound gorilla of Atlanta. And Anime Weekend is actually, Weekend Atlanta, which is the name of the convention, is we're the number two convention. And we drove, what was the last thing, about 15,000 last year?
No,
that's Dragon.
We did 4,600 people.
So that's not bad. That's a decent size show.
We were expecting 5.
Right.
So we're like, oh, we only did 4,000. But 4,000, and that's, I may point out here that a lot of conventions will count, like if you go to the convention Friday, they count one. And if you go to the convention Saturday, well, that's two.
Yeah, MegaCon in Orlando was big on that.
Forget that. We had 4,600 people that paid money to come to our show.
That's a lot of people.
That's tickets we sold, not by day, by ticket.
Well, that's one of the ways you finance. Okay, now, but, you know, that comes after it. Now, when you want to, you know, you got to get a hotel in order to do this show. And you got to get a place to do it. So how do you go about getting the money to begin this before you have, because, you know, advanced ticket sales can take a while.
What we did was Gordon gave us $100. And that's how AWA got started. He gave us $100.
What did you do with that $100? Where did that go?
I gave it to Lloyd.
Oh,
Lloyd Carter is the treasurer of AWA.
He is really, though, he is
because
really
if
the
I
nuts
had
and
that
bolts.
Money, if I had the control of that bank account, I would be short one month, and I'd say, well, I'll just borrow $50, and I'll pay it back, and I would never pay it back.
Right.
because I know myself well enough to know I would just, I'm not to be trusted.
And you're not the only one. I don't want to get into that too much.
So what we did was we went to the castle gate and said, and we looked around at a lot of hotels. I mean, you'll remember that. We pretty much spent our weekends going from hotel to hotel and saying, yeah, we're doing a con. And they're really nice to you at these hotels when you know, you're looking to put on an event. You know, they want to show off.
That's business for them.
It's business.
Now, what are the hotels mostly interested in when you're looking for a room? I mean, because obviously...
Oh, they want to fill... They want to give their catering department something to do, so they want you to have a nice dinner where, you know, you $30 a head for rubber chicken and stale rolls,
mm-hmm.
dinner with the stars or whatever. I think those are really stupid, so that's how I feel about those. The second thing they want you to do is to fill room nights, and they want people to come in to their hotel because you're holding your con.
Okay, explain what a room night is.
That's you build, room 101 is filled for Friday night. That's a room night.
And if you build 101 for Friday and Saturday, that's two room nights. So basically one room per night.
Yeah. So what we've done, and what I can't even remember what our rates were at the Castle Gate, but most legitimate hotels are going to rent you the convention space on a sliding scale based on how many room nights you fill. If you fill 50 room nights, you get the convention space for $500.
Right.
If you fill 100 room nights, you get it for free. Or anything over, you get it for free, you know, or whatever. You know, it varies from hotel to hotel. It's all negotiable. Everything is negotiable with a hotel.
And you didn't have to put any money up front to the hotel.
We had to give them about $300.
That's not too bad, though.
Minuscule amount.
Yeah, that's not too bad.
Actually,
I
want to say it was half.
Yeah, that was raised. I mean, it was the 90s, and a lot of people were working, so everybody had a little bit of money to contribute. But where did you get the bulk of the money before you even started selling tickets?
No, we sold dealer's table.
Now, dealer's table is where someone will come in and they're saying, okay, we want to sell our stuff because we know you're going to have X amount of people, or we assume you're going to have X amount
of
people.
Sure, and we filled that dealer's room, too.
Yeah, yeah, and that was Matt Buffington because he had all the connections.
He worked at Titans for years. He knows a lot of people, and what's interesting is that Laura Block's husband, Laura's an old friend of mine, she knew Matt. He didn't know me. But he knew Matt.
Oh, okay.
So
I thought he was like part of the crowd for a while.
No, he had never met me. I might have met him once, and so it's strange because he knows a lot of people. We went to the same school too. So he sold, and we actually sold dealer's tables very cheaply. We cut everybody a really sweet deal because most cons are going to charge. Dragon Con dealer's tables are $2,500 right now.
Right, and that's that for the whole thing, or is that per night, per day?
Well, per table. That's for the weekend.
Right.
Per table.
We
cut everybody a really sweet deal, and we had a lot of dealers, and that helped us get us over the hump. And we didn't sell quite 100 pre-registered members before the show, and we wound up doing about 300 people. So that's a pretty good percentage.
Right.
And we had, I can recall the Thursday before the show, we had found out that we could hold the con right now and nobody could show up and we would still make money.
And that's very unusual for convention, isn't it?
As near as I can tell, that's the only time it's ever happened.
Well, Anime Weekend it set kind of a record because it actually posted a fairly decent profit its first 5 years. And, do you think a lot of that, though, had to do with the fact that anime was the up-and-coming thing? I mean, you couldn't have
certainly.
Done the same thing with the sci-fi show.
Certainly not, yeah.
Which is what I tried to do. Why did I fail with the sci-fi summer, Dave?
Because you flew in those stars.
My overhead was too high, we over-anticipated what our attendance was going to be.
And that's a killer. And, you know, because people start new cons, like, every day.
Right.
And these cons are all like, we're going to have 10,000 people, and we're going to do this. And it's like, dude, don't do it. Don't have T-shirts. Don't have a con suite. Don't print your program book all in full color. Don't fly in. Name your big shot guests. You know, don't do any of that stuff. Just have your little con, and if you can't do it personally, don't do it.
Now, who was the big guest at the first Anime Week in Atlanta?
I think guest Robert Woodhead.
And he was the head of Animego, which is a company that sells anime tapes that they dub over. Or revoice.
Actually, I just got a DVD version of their first release.
The Ursa Yatsura?
No, Maddox 01.
Okay.
Metal Skin Panic Maddox 01, which was the first time an American company released a subtitled Japanese cartoon commercially on home video in the United States.
Now, let's tell the story about Mr. Woodhead, because we had the misfortune at Anime Week in Atlanta 1, which was, 94? Was it 94?
95.
And that was the year that the Braves were going to the World Series. In fact, it was the year they won the World Series.
Yes.
And that same weekend that we were holding Anime Weekend, the Braves were playing a series game.
Yeah.
And also the Dallas Cowboys were in town to play the Falcons that weekend. And so
busy.
The Castlegate was like really filled with hotel rooms.
They were double booked.
And yeah, they were very upset that they had this little convention here, that even though we had filled our room block, they could have sold those rooms for a lot more. So what happened with Mr. Woodhead? Tell this story.
Oh, well, what they did was he checked in, and then he went up to go into his room, and the key wouldn't work. And he went to the front desk, and they gave him a key, and he went into his room, and there was somebody else's stuff all in his room. And they had sold his room to somebody else.
Remarkable.
Yeah, well, this is the Castlegate.
The Castlegate had a kind of reputation. We also... We suspected, and we can't prove anything, so maybe we shouldn't talk too much. Well, they're out of business, so who gives
what?
A shit? That they were like going through our rooms, looking for stuff. And
well, I know that one of our guests left his door ajar, and like for 2 minutes, and a camera was stolen out of his room.
And and
it wasn't even his camera.
It's a strange ass hotel. I remember a few years after we obviously moved on. It was only the only year that we were at the Castlegate, but a few years after, we just had like a party.
Yeah.
Up there, and we were in this wing, we were on the second floor.
We were in the pimp wing.
Yeah, and it's like the second floor, and you get the window, and there's like no grating. There's no, you know, you open the window, and it's just air. And
yeah.
Someone could just jump to their death out there.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, oh my God, how can they do this? And, you know, we had asked because they knew we were having a party. And so they put us in, we said, let's put us in a wing where there's not going to be anybody so that, you know, our noise won't bother anybody. And what was funny was there was some people who complained about the noise, so they got a reduction on the room, and then we complained about the noise.
Yeah, that's what Matt did. He went up and complained. That guy's got balls. Yeah, it was really noisy, and we couldn't get any sleep, so we want our money back.
The Castlegate.
See, and that's the thing about a business like the Castlegate is, if you go into it expecting going to Walmart, you're going to pay $1.98 and get your product, you're going to get screwed.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be wary every minute that what are they going to do to me? What can I do to them? It's a great game. It's a lot of fun, actually.
Do you ever consider running a hotel?
Yeah, I think it'd be a lot of fun, actually. I wouldn't want to deal with all the labor problems, but it would be fun to have a hotel.
So maybe you can do a thing like in the story Ozone Commandos, one of the things is like this floating hotel that's like a constant convention going on. I mean, obviously, we can't do the floating part. I mean, you get a hotel together, somebody hits the lottery or something, you buy a hotel and you use it for nothing but conventions. Every
have
single
a different
week.
Show every week.
Yeah, comic book shows, sci-fi shows, anime shows, you name it, you have it all.
Boy, there would be people living in that hotel, actually.
That would be cool.
Actually, you could do that. I mean, a lot of these extended stay places, it's not much more than rent.
Yeah, that's true.
A lot of these people would do that if you could give them a DVD player. Oh, I'm just going to stay here. High-speed internet, you know.
Well, listen, it's been real great talking. We've been going on for like 30 minutes now, which doesn't even seem like it's 30 minutes. So, Dave, I'd love to have you on the show from time to time, just telling old stories and stuff like that.
Can
about
you call me up?
And I don't want to call you up because it's like 10 to 1 right now.
Yeah,
and,
I'm up late.
You're up late. Okay, well, if I want to get your opinion on a specific
sure.
thing that's going on, because I know you cover politics. Do you want to give out your live journal?
It's just Dave Merrill. Merrill.
Okay, but you do got to get on like livejournal.com.
Yeah.
So just
you got to go to LiveJournal and then look for Dave Merrill.
Look for Dave Merrill. And it's a really nice little journal there. And I noticed you made a slight change to the look of it.
Yeah.
It looks a lot nicer.
Yeah.
So was that one of their templates or did you?
It's one of theirs. I don't have a paid account.
Right. So that's cool. Well, you know, that's one of the great thing about the internet is that guys like you and me can just get on there and spill our guts out.
You know, it's all thanks to nerds.
It's all thanks to nerds.
I don't think we pay enough homage to nerds in our society.
There you go. Well, Dave Merrill, thanks for being on the show, and I maybe give you a call next week, okay?
Okay.
Take care, Dave.
Thanks a lot.
The Copper Joe Radio Show.
Good news, everyone.
Uh-oh. I don't like the sound of that.
You'll be making a delivery to the planet Trisol.
Here it comes.
A mysterious world in the darkest depths of the Forbidden Zone.
Thank you, and good night.
Professor, are we even allowed in the Forbidden Zone?
Why, of course. It's just a name, like the Death Zone or the Zone of No Return. All the zones have names like that. In the galaxy of terror.
Professor...
Off you go. Pleasant trip.
We'll be right back.
Refreshments. Theme from King of the Hill. Great theme. Great TV show, too. Before that, we had Puffy AmiYumi. The theme from the Teen Titans. Another great theme. I love that kind of a mixing with new and the old retro 60s guitar type of deal. Really, really nice. And we began with a little clip from, and then the theme from Futurama, which is by Danny Elfman, who is a true musical genius. That is a really wonderful theme. Elfman has done a lot of different themes. He first came of note, although he had been working before, of course, but he did the theme for the first Batman movie, which even though the movie was not as good as everyone said it was, the music from it was fantastic, and he's been doing a lot of different themes. He also does the music for The Simpsons, among other things. How is everybody doing? I am Joe Vecchio, and this is the Cup of Joe radio show, and I am the voice of the working man and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. And before we go on any further with anything else, let me remind you of the URL. That's http://cupojoe.blogspot.com. That's cupojoe.blogspot.com. No www. Well, you can if you want, I think, but it's not really necessary because Blogspot doesn't do that. Blogspot. Excuse me. Blogspot. Make sure that's right. Didn't want an to sound like an O. But it's cupojoe.blogspot.com, and I want to hear from you. Email me, joevec@bellsouth.net. And you can also, of course, get the show from the archives at whiterosesociety.org. And I want to thank Ben Birch for putting it up there. And, you know, I'm trying to get in to some other places. What was it called? It was Rant Radio. It was one place. But Radio Power, that's the one I wanted to get in on. And I contacted them, and they emailed me, and so on and so forth. And they said, yeah, we can find a spot for you. And they sent me the FTP information so I can send the show over. And that's fine. And I haven't heard a damn word from them yet. Are you guys awake out there? Are you all alive? You know, you're looking for shows. You're looking for spots. Here I am. I do about an hour and 20 minutes. I do two shows a week. I try to keep a regular schedule. That's me. Thursdays and Sundays. Those are the days I shoot for. Now, Rant Radio was talking. It's rantradio.com and radiopower.org, I believe that is. Let me double-check on the website there. I'll just plug up the handy thing there. No, that's not it. There we go. Radio Power. It is radiopower.org, yeah. And the other one is rantradio.com. And they're both very good. I mean, they carry a lot of different shows, and I'm all, you know, and they're looking for content. And here I am. And Rant Radio, they're having some technical questions concerning, you know, because they don't do pre-recorded shows. They do live shows. And they got some great people on there, like Sean Kennedy. Sean Kennedy rocks. Sean Kennedy's like, he curses like a fucking sailor. I'm not quite as bad as he is. I'm not quite as fast as he is. You know, I listen to all these other performers, and they're all really smooth. And, you know, a lot of them are like either professional or they're just really naturally smooth. And I'm not that way. I'm just – And this is what separates me from a lot of these guys. I am just a guy with a microphone and an opinion. I do not have a real smooth voice. I'm told I have a nice radio voice, but I listen to myself and I think to myself, I am not real smooth and real professional like these guys are. I do the best I can, and I think I do a pretty good show here. But, you know, and I do this all alone. I do the whole show by myself, and I really could use some help. If there's anybody in the Atlanta area that can help me out, you know, somebody help me do a little research, help me pick the songs for the show, you know, come in every now and then and help me record a segment, you know, in the afternoon before I go to work so I have somebody to talk to and feedback on. I'm going to be calling my friend Dave Merrill on a little more regular basis just so I have somebody to talk to about stuff. And just, you know, let me spice it up a little bit more. I don't mean in a sense of profanity, but just you know, try to get a little more than just me yakking, you know. And I mean, I know people don't mind it, and you have a certain amount of listeners, and people do like me, and I have fans for the show, but I really would like to get just something up there to spice it up a little bit and get it so that it really does sound more like a regular radio show and not just some nut screaming from his bedroom, which is basically all it is at this point. I did have a guy who emailed me, and he said he was going to help me out, and, you know, We talked over email a couple times, and we talked on the phone a couple times, and And he came over and we talked for about 5 minutes. And that was it. I hardly ever heard from him. I mean, it was like, that was like 2 weeks ago, and I've heard from him maybe twice since. Now, and I'm wondering if when we met that this guy just decided, you know, fuck it, I wasn't worth it, and maybe that's the case. You know, because quite frankly, I'm no great shakes in person. You know, I don't have a very impressive personality. I don't have a very... I'm not one of those people who, if you meet, you know, you're instantly, you know, awed by your personality, like some people are. And I guess that really comes off much more in person than it does over the radio. So maybe this guy just looked at me and said, what the fuck is up with this guy? I ain't getting anywhere near this asshole. And I think that's probably what happened. And, you know, but I really do need, you know, really what I'd like to do is if I had some of my old friends on and just somebody who was a friend, because when you're hosting a show and when you're with a partner, it really helps that if you're friends with the person and that you have a rapport when you talk with them. And I really don't have that. And I do wonder, if it's just me, if I just get on people's nerves. And I know that being someone with an opinion and someone who's as opinionated as I am, they tend to get on people's nerves anyway. But you figured you would expect that from people working on a radio show and people helping out. I mean, I have an ego. I'm not going to lie about that. I have an ego. If I didn't have an ego and didn't have a little bit of a desire to spew my opinions out, I wouldn't be doing this show. You know, why the hell else do I do this? Now, and you know, the thing about it is, and I look over my whole life, and I'm sure all of you have felt that way, and, you know, I just feel inadequate. I was reading, I bought a copy of the New Yorker magazine. I don't generally buy it. It's a really good magazine if you like reading, because it's really got a lot of very good articles in this particular one. I bought because they had a lot of articles about comedy, and I was reading about some stand-up comedians and how their, you know, how their work and lives are coming along. And it's a very difficult life for a young up and coming stand-up comedian. I mean, it doesn't just happen overnight. You know, it takes a long time to get in there. And there was also some articles about Harold Ramis, and there were some very funny stories. One was like about a murderer, you know, say, oh, he's just a murderer day by day. I really don't want to read the whole article. It was very brilliantly written. Now, you know, I write on the blog, and I do get compliments from my writing sometimes, and I think I'm a decent writer. At the very least, I can put together a coherent sentence and turn a phrase fairly well. But I look at these people, and I look at the writing in there, and I say, I'm nowhere near at this level. I just suck when it compares to that. I mean, and I'm not... trying to be a Hemingway or an Asimov or any of the great writers that there have been, but, you know, certainly no Shakespeare or anybody like that, you know, a really, really great writer, or a Truman Capote. I'm nothing like that, and I'm never going to be that talented. When I write very straightforwardly, and I try to use as little words as possible. I'm really much more of what's that guy's name? The one of the famous liberal writers, but he calls them pamphleteers. Basically, and that's pretty much what I am. I write what amount to political treatises, and I have a little bit more problem writing what would be considered literature or anything above and beyond just letters to the editor or stuff like that. I'm good at letters to the editor. Don't get me wrong. Because I can write concisely and shortly and make a quick point, I've gotten a lot of letters printed in the letters to the editor. You'd be surprised. If you stick on a subject that they have a specific article. And this is my little clues to anybody out there who thinks about writing letters to the editor and who wants to get read in newspapers. Keep it short. Mention a specific article or you know, talk about a specific article that they've had in their newspaper. Don't start out with "Dear Assholes." You're not going to get printed starting out "Dear Assholes." But if you keep it concise like that and keep it to a thing, you can even be insulting if you're insulting in an intelligent way. But the important thing is to be short. And I can speak from experience that this works because I've had lots of letters to the editor printed. I've had letters to the editor printed in every major newspaper in this country. The three biggest ones, which would be, well, I don't count USA Today. I think I've had one printed in there too, but I'm not sure. I don't count USA Today because really, their numbers, it's kind of like the bulk sales for Republican books. They get their numbers because they go into hotels and sell in bulk to stuff like that. But I've had letters printed in the LA Times, Chicago Tribune, and twice in the New York Times. Twice in the New York Times. And if I can get a letter published in the New York Times, then anybody can get a letter published in the New York Times. But that just goes to show the power of writing concisely and clearly and making your point if you're a letter to the editor. But I look at these other writers and these professional writers, which is something I would love to be able to do, is be a professional writer. And I'm like, I just can't. I'm not that good. You know, and I need a lot more work on it. And I look at it, and I'm not saying my work is bad by any stretch of the imagination. I read my work, and even I get impressed sometimes by some of the things I can put on paper. And I'm not a very easy person to impress. But I know, and I can be self-critical. And I know that I'm simply not good enough to be a professional writer just yet. Again, not at any level above that simple pamphleteer, letters to the editor type deal. I'm really just not capable of it yet. Yet. And I am working on it. And I don't write as much on the blog as I would like to write, mainly because now I'm working 40 hours a week, and when I get home, I'm tired. Writing is hard work, and you have to be in a strong frame of mind to be able to be coherent when you write, because when I get tired, I tend to just really, really ramble on and stuff, as you can tell from the way I talk sometimes. So, but anyway, I'm going to put an end to this a little early this segment, a little short for this segment, because we had a nice long segment with Mr. Merrill. And we're going to go back to the end, I guess. Go back to the end. Is that right? See, again, I'm rambling. See, this is what I do. This is what I do. This is who I am. I ramble. I'm a rambling guy. And who was it? One of my readers, Rick Hall. Is that his name, Rick Hall? I don't want to go into the thing and find out. But he was kind of making fun of my musical tastes when I played both Kung Fu Fighting and the Convoy in the last show. And he dared me to play Disco Duck. And I'm not going to do that this episode. But I might hold it for a surprise. Because as scary as it may sound, I actually have Disco Duck in my archives here. Because it was one of those fucking goofy songs that came out of the 70s and shit. So anyway, until next time, which should be Sunday, hopefully. This is Joe Vecchio signing off from the Cup of Joe Radio Show. Oh,
Thank you and good night.